following interview was conducted with Professor Johnny Christian for the Purdue University Oral History Project. It took place on Tuesday, November 28, 2006, at his home at 1301 Woodland Avenue, West Lafayette. The interviewer was Catherine Marquis, the oral history librarian. This is part two.
Okay.
Let me talk a little bit about diversity in the school and how has it changed through the years, the demographics and enrollment.
Yeah, well, and I came here to Purdue in 1935 as an undergraduate, and there were about 2,500 students, and it increased each year up until probably 46, 47 after the war. There was a big expansion. It went from probably 10,000 up to 20,000 plus. I don't know the exact figures, but that was a tremendous jump. When the boys came home, they had the privilege of going to school, and the schools all were crowded. And we even had students sleeping in the gymnasium. Didn't have enough housing. And a lot of temporary structures went up to accommodate that big influx. And then, of course, it's steadily increased now since that time. What do we have, about 39,000 students here on campus now. Mm-hmm. So it's been a significant change, and also the physical plan. The new buildings that have come on campus since 1935, it's almost unbelievable.
A whole different look.
Yeah, a whole different look and a whole different objective. Research is emphasized now. Of course, the teaching has expanded. Lots of new professors and so on to go with the new students.
Sure.
So there's been, a tremendous change in the university. Even the athletic facilities have expanded over that period of time.
Quite a period, yeah.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about the pharmacy school. You know, established in 1884 through the efforts of Smart and the physician, Dr. Hootie. You served under three deans, Dr. Jenkins, Dr. Tyler, and Dr. Rutledge. Any little bit about how the curriculum and management style and students, anything on contrasting their eras?
Well, as I started in 35, I think there maybe were six professors, and Dean Jordan was dean of the school, and he was very much student-oriented. He interacted with the students very well, but he had a heart attack. Well, let's see, I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself. I finished then in 39 and went to the Upjohn Company, Kalamazoo, Michigan, as my first position in research and analytical. And I came back then 1 year later, in 1940, as a graduate student. And Dean Jordan was to be my major professor. Well, he passed away, he had a heart attack. And that's when they brought in Jenkins. Dean Jenkins became the dean. And I, of course, had to transfer major professor. So Jenkins became my major professor. And during that period under Jenkins, the research aspects of pharmacy were accelerated very rapidly and became the top school in the United States in pharmaceutical and analytical research. And he was primarily responsible for that, was his major objective. And of course, I progressed I finished my graduate work in 44 and then stayed on the faculty, and I progressed with Jenkins right along with that growth. And in that that period, which I was appointed as an assistant professor, 1945, and associate professor in 48, and full professor in 1950. And in the interim, I was heading up, started the bionucleonics department. I started the division of radiological control. And as late as 1978-79, I started the new school of health sciences. And then I finished my administrative work. I retired about 1988.
Was Dean Jenkins, was he on the faculty at that time, or was he somebody from new to the university?
He was new to the university. He came from the University of Wisconsin. Very outstanding man.
He came as dean?
Yes, the dean of the schools of pharmacy and pharmaceutical sciences. And he did the pharmaceutical sciences part. That was the new big expansion. Mm-hmm. And we had, we had two or three graduate students when I started. But almost with the war, after the war and so on, that expanded to up to 70 graduate students in the School of Pharmacy. Quite a significant expansion.
And he was, and then did Dean Tyler came after him?
Yes.
Okay.
Dean Tyler came after
him. He was from the, he was not with us on the staff at that time, was he?
No, he came from the University of Washington,
okay.
Seattle.
Okay.
Yeah. And then, I don't know the exact year, but in the 80s, he became vice president of the university.
Now, had you, when Dr. Rutledge was the dean, were you still, or had you retired?
I had retired about that time,
okay,
yes.
Okay.
I don't know what year he came now, but must have been the late 80s.
Mm-hmm. Was there, did you notice that Dean Jenkins was pretty student-oriented? Was that true with the others then?
Yes.
He more student-oriented?
They were all very much student-oriented, but Jenkins was more scientific than the other two,
mm-hmm,
in terms of that whole period of expansion.
Sure.
The others were interested in research also, but Jenkins really developed it.
In the graduate enrollment, and of course, one of the changes was now a 5-year program to get.
Yes.
Did that take place during that time? Or?
That took place officially under, after Jenkins retired,
mm-hmm,
about that time. You have the year there that Jenkins retired?
I don't have it here.
Okay.
Yeah, no.
Well, I've kind of forgotten when that was.
But I knew that, in doing some research, I knew that those approximately were the times when you would have been there, that they were the
days. Yes.
And Jenkins was about the earliest
yes,
one.
Uh-huh.
You were talking earlier about buildings, and pharmacy schools had several buildings, and then 1970 you dedicated the current building.
Yes.
That was kind of a big event.
Big event, yes, you bet.
Yes. They built a brand new facility, didn't they? Is that what it was?
Oh, yes.
That, rather than where it was before? Was
yeah, where it was, that became Student Affairs Building.
Schliemann Hall when that...
Schliemann Hall now.
That's right.
That was the old pharmacy.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Were you involved at all in any of that planning for the new building?
Yeah, yes, very closely. And what happened there during the expansion of the undergraduate program after the war, the university brought in a number of temporary buildings. They were old army barracks, and we had just north of the old pharmacy building this temporary building.
Where Armstrong is being built, the temporary buildings, was that about the time that they were built?
Yes. And and during that period, Jenkins started it, but then the next dean,
Tyler,
was the dean when it was built. Uh-huh. And all the faculty were deeply involved in that
plan.
The design of that building.
Is it where it's located? Was that in the same area that the original building was?
Yes, it's adjacent, actually.
Okay.
The old pharmacy building, then that temporary structure, and then the new pharmacy building, and the hospital.
So you were involved in. Another milestone was in 1984, your centennial. What was the nature of the celebration? I learned that also President Reagan sent his best wishes. Well, you must have been. Tell us a little about the centennial. That's kind of neat.
Well, yes. It was a gala year. Had lots of prominent speakers came in.
Was it sort of a year-long thing?
A year-long celebration. Yeah, I remember Reagan sending a letter of appreciation.
Yeah. And then several years after that, he visited Purdue. He was here in
1987. Yes.
Did you interact with him when he was here?
No, I didn't.
Because you'd served on a committee that in the early years on an energy thing.
Oh, yes.
So you'd
that
met
was
him.
Later on.
Sure.
He appointed me.
Yeah.
The energy committee, but I wasn't involved at that time, but I did hear him speak in the football field. That's where he spoke.
I thought he was in Mackey Arena, wasn't it?
Okay. Football field.
Okay.
Mackey Arena wouldn't have held him.
Now, about the health sciences, tell us about the school, and then what departments comprise that particular school at the moment?
Well, as I said, the School of Health Sciences was started by myself, Provost Haas, and President Hanson started the new School of Health Sciences. And it was mainly what we call health physics, which is the safe use of ionizing radiation, including X-rays. But primarily the safe use of radioactive materials, which had just become, in that period, become available in the 40s and the 50s. And that was a big expansion countrywide, and it was a very big problem about how to handle radioactive materials because they could be hazardous. And that was a big segment of the new School of Health Sciences, which was called Bionucleonics.
Before that?
Before that, we had the Department of Bionucleonics. And when the school was formed, Bionucleonics became a part of the new school. And then we had industrial hygiene and hospital practitioner area. And there's some new areas have been added that I'm not really up to date on. Mm-hmm. And I've been retired for 20 years. A lot of changes.
That's a short time.
Well,
it really is.
Yeah.
Put into perspective. When the school was first started, was it primarily grad students or did they have undergraduates?
But again, it was primarily graduate students. Mm-hmm. The bionucleonics department was all graduate. One time, as head of the department, we had 55 graduate students in bionucleonics alone, which was part of the School of Pharmacy.
I see. Okay. But now there's undergraduates in the school as well?
Yes.
As well as graduate programs.
Yeah. Okay. The fact is the undergraduates have grown more than the graduate mm-hmm. school in the school.
What are some of the placement, where do some of these people go, undergraduate level?
Well, a large number of them go to federal agencies like the nuclear laboratories where they do research on the new weapons of mass destruction, atomic energy, and several of them go there, and we have the undergraduates going to hospitals as hospital technicians handling the radioactive materials and the X-rays, responsible for that whole health safety area. Mm-hmm. Several of them are, for example, in Rochester, Mayo Clinic, mm-hmm. to control the safe use of ionizing radiation.
What about the graduate program? What do some of the graduate students do? Some of them go on for the PhD? Or?
Oh, most of them did.
Okay.
Yeah, I still do.
I see. Do they go into teaching or more research?
A lot of them go into teaching and government, again, government agencies, mm-hmm. and in the industry. We have a number at Eli Lilly, for example, Mallinckrodt Chemical. So on the general pharmaceutical industry hires PhDs mm-hmm. out of our program.
I see. Okay. And the program is pretty good size, so the school is pretty good.
Yes.
Enrollment's increased over time.
Yes.
Now we talk about another one of your favorite things, samurai. Tell us a little bit about it. I know that you've given some interviews, but if you just share a few reminiscences about it for our researchers that may or may not have a chance to visit.
About what area?
Samurai, your house.
Oh, your Samara. House.
Yes, Samara. Yes.
Samara, okay.
Yes.
Well, it's a long story, but
just
briefly.
Some general reminiscences as you think of that.
My wife and I were married in 1948. And we both were at the university, had a lot of students. And my wife was very much socially oriented. She was a social director for the university. And one of the things we decided we wanted in our married life was something different in our home, a place where we could entertain students. Knowing that, we knew we had to have an architect. So we started looking, interviewed some in Chicago, and finally ran across Frank Lloyd Wright, a house he had built in Pleasantville, New York. While I attended a meeting, my wife went up to see it. She liked it so well, and she insisted I go. I, too, liked it. And so we decided we wanted Frank Lloyd Wright as our architect. Well, as we did research, we found out in 1950, Frank Lloyd Wright is 83 years old. He's already 83. It's the busiest time of his professional career. He's doing the Guggenheim in New York, a Jewish synagogue in Philadelphia, Price Tower in Oklahoma, Marin County government, very busy. Yeah, and lots of residences. He was even doing a palace for the Princess of Iraq at that time. Well, here we were, a young couple in West Lafayette with limited resources, which means, of course, we didn't have any money, wanting to hire this now world-famous architect. And how do we do that? I was very frustrated. So one day, out of pure frustration, I picked up the phone and called his office. And a very fortunate thing happened. He answered the phone. Normally, one of his secretaries, or he had 55 apprentices working for him, one of them would have answered. And they told me later, if we'd gotten one of them, they'd have said, forget it, there's no way. As busy as Mr. Wright is, he's going to design a small home in West Lafayette they never heard of for a young couple without any money. Well, turned out, Wright is very gracious. And we had a nice conversation. He invited us up to his home, Taliesin, in Spring Green, Wisconsin. And nothing happened at that first meeting, but another fortunate thing happened. He invited us back. 6 months later, we went back. And halfway through that conversation, I simply blurted out, well, Mr. Wright, will you design a home for us? And he hesitated. He looked around the room. Cleared his throat, you know, like he was going to say no, too busy or whatnot. But instead, he very enthusiastically said, of course, I'll design your home. But then, with a gleam in his eyes, you can see it there in the mannequin, he turned to my wife and he said, Mrs. Christian, how much money you got? And he knew we didn't have any pulling our leg. And that was the last thing we wanted to talk about. So my wife recovered more quickly than I did. She said, well, Mr. Wright, she had a gleam in her eye and a smile. She said, we you don't have any money. We all laughed like it was a joke. It wasn't a joke. But he knew that, and irrespective, agreed
they
to build our...
You had respect for each other.
Yes, we had a good rapport. He liked us, and we liked him, and it just worked out. Yeah, very fortunate.
But he never came here, though, did he?
Never here.
Never saw the house.
No, he was never here, either before or after. Kay invited him on more than one occasion. The last time she invited him, he was giving a lecture in Indianapolis. He was 90 years old, was still very active, and she called him, and he very graciously again declined. He was much too busy. But then he said, which is typical, he said, "But Mrs. Christian, I don't need to see your house. I know what it looks like." And he did, no question.
Did you already have the property before?
Yes, we did. Oh. And it's interesting.
Before you even decided, or
yes.
Was it coinciding with that you wanted right to build your home?
Yes. We purchased this lot in 1948 before we knew anything about right. And it's interesting to point out that there's 7 acres here east of the U.S. 52 highway, and that was owned at that time, 1948, by the Purdue Research Foundation. And the plans were to build the president's new home here on this site. But President Hovde didn't want to live on the west side. He wanted to live over in Lafayette, away from the students, I guess. Anyway, he had a home on 7th Street. And so the university, this is all the land they own, decided to sell 7 one-acre lots. And my wife and I were fortunate to get this 1 acre. And Mr. Wright liked the lot.
Did you show him pictures of
the lot? Yeah, okay. All the detail, photographs, terrain maps, trees, okay.
He had it surveyed and everything.
Yeah, all the details. And he took that, and he liked it. And he asked us how large it was. I told him it was a little over an acre. And he said, "Good thing. But anything less than that, I would not design your house." Because he was demanding at least an acre in that state. So that's a little quick story about
that. That's very... And the furnishings that with the house... Maybe they were covering something, but I'm asking you, did you get some of them originally, and have you added to them, or tell us a little bit about how they come about?
Well, we had an agreement with Mr. Wright, since we had limited funds, that he would do all the plans for everything, and then we would add to the house as we lived in it, using those plans. So at the beginning, there were this room, of course there are lots of built-ins. See all those built-in seats over there. But the furniture, most of the furniture that you see here, like the hassocks, these tables, the high fidelity, and the amusement center over here, were built before we moved in. But then, as we were able, we added his design plan, which were made specifically for this house, from his plan. And we never altered that. We agreed to all of his plans. There were about 150 plans, drawings, sketches, great detail. And every year we added. And I'm still, after 50 years, I'm still adding.
But you've added some of the furnishings as well over time, have you?
Oh, yes. Oh. This lamp, for example.
Okay.
This lamp here was about 1990. Maybe 95.
Is it difficult to get the furnishings today versus years ago?
Well, it's difficult in the sense that he specified Philippine mahogany throughout. Everything had to be one wood. And it's difficult to get Philippine mahogany. But we had that all made, you see.
Sure.
Made according to his drawing.
Specifications.
devised a theme for the house based on winged seeds. That's what Samara means, winged seeds. They're winged seeds and pine cones. That's why you see the pine cones over there. And I had a lot of evergreens. He picked up on that and said, you're going to have winged seeds. And he named the house Samara and then made a motif from his concept as an artist of what a winged seed looked like. And the most obvious you see is in the rug, right here.
The rug?
Those are winged seeds, as he depicted from the pine cone. And then he used that theme throughout. You see it in many places in the house. Well, it's a little difficult, but here's a piece of furniture right here with a lamp. You see the base has the theme and the dining room chairs, stationery. He designed our stationery, my business card, bedspread, bathroom linens, table, all with the Samara motif.
Wonderful.
Ties everything together.
Yeah, wonderful. And you really enjoyed it, and you still give tours and
of course. Oh yeah, I think it was last night.
Oh, did you?
I should have invited you.
Oh well.
Never thought about this. I'll invite you now to come sometime.
I will appreciate that. Now, some of them are going to be on permanent display. We address this, I think, at one time. The West Lafayette Public Library are on permanent display there. Is that?
It's not permanent.
Okay.
We had the major display ran from April 2nd to July 30th.
Of this year?
Yes. And we had lots of educational programs around that and lots of visitations here. I've had miniature replicas of all the furniture made. This is a miniature replica of these triangular tables. And these were on display until last week in one of the cases there in the library. But they took it down because they had another display.
Mm-hmm.
And these are in storage at the moment.
Well, I think you did mention, is there going to be an exhibit in Cincinnati of some sort?
We're still working on that.
Okay.
And we hopefully start that next spring, March or April.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And it's already been in 12 different locations, 4 different states.
The same exhibit that was in the West Office?
Yeah, it's moved around the Midwest.
And you're storing it there, the material, the things are stored there?
Yes.
Well, that makes it easier then.
Well, yeah, it's wonderful to have that.
Sure.
We have one big room down in the basement.
That's very good.
Where we store right. the exhibit.
Okay. And kind of wrapping up, a couple things. There was a quote which I read, pharmacy is more than running a corner store. Got any comment? This is something I guess you said. Any comment on that or you remember?
Well, yes.
Okay.
Corner drugstore, of course, is still very important as a source of pharmaceuticals and information about health information.
Sure.
But you have the whole area of the production of pharmaceuticals. There, I don't know how many pharmaceutical companies, large number, maybe 50, 60, who make specific pharmaceutical. Eli Lilly, you're familiar with, is a good example. They make many different pharmaceutical products which are then distributed out to the hospitals and to the pharmacies. And that's a big area of pharmacy responsibility, because pharmacists have to formulate and then produce it. They have to put the sugar coating on the pills, that sort of thing. Capsules, fill the capsules and so forth. That's a big area. And then, of course, the research component, that's part of the pharmaceutical industry. They're doing continuous research, trying to find new medicinal substances to treat diseases. And then, of course, we have the whole field of education, schools of pharmacy. About 60 of those. Then they branch off into areas like government positions, Food and Drug Administration.
years since you retired from Purdue, what has been sort of meaningful and enjoyable? And is there kind of an outstanding, if I asked you if there was an outstanding event, would you recall one?
Well, the general outstanding event is this house. And that's what I've devoted my energies to since I retired. And that has worked out very well. We have a program where we bring in up to 50 people at a time. This room does seat 50 people. It was designed for that. And we lecture to them about Frank Lloyd Wright, about the architecture of this house. And we tour the house and outside as well. And then there are questions and answers. They come back here, questions and answers, and demonstrations. And it takes about 2 hours. And we think that's important, that we don't encourage people just to come and walk through. They don't get much out of it. They don't understand it. So we almost religiously require, if they want to learn about Frank Lloyd Wright in this house, they have to come here and spend 2 hours.
That's
right. And last year we had over 2,500 people. Most of them were elementary students. 50-mile radius, we have classes of all kinds coming in, and that has been built up over the last 12 years. And they come back each year. So that's a big, big group. And then, of course, we have women's clubs, professional.
Is this primarily local, or do you get some from outside?
Oh, outside. You want to come December 7th at 7 p.m., I'll have 50 people from Wichita, Kansas. It's all set, and they're coming. There's a Frank Lloyd Wright home in Wichita, and thus the interest.
They're coming on a tour to see this
one? On a tour. Busload.
Okay.
And yes, and I have many foreign visitors. They come from all over the world.
Hope they give you some advance notice.
Oh, yeah, I would require advance notice. I require a reservation. I have people coming to the door just off the cuff, and I always hate to do that, but they make a reservation.
That's appropriate.
We'll set up a time. Otherwise, I'd be spending my time, 2 hours, 2 or 3 hours, with 2 or 3 people, and I can't do that anymore.
This is a special thing and should be treated accordingly. That one
becomes
a special event.
And I have 30 volunteers who help.
Oh, that's good.
Speakers, they speak.
Let's see, I've got a couple of things. Any questions that I failed to ask or any comments that you want to make on anything special?
Well, let's see. You mentioned last time the possibility of a brief discussion on my relationship with the presidents of the universe.
Okay.
And you saw this article in the Journal and Courier on all the presidents. There were 10. There have been 10 presidents. Mm-hmm. And I was fortunate to work under 5 of those presidents during my 48 years. And the first one was Edward Elliott. Elliot was an elegant, fluent speaker, very dynamic, and he was a good student. He was interested in students. And he retired in 1946. That's about the time I became an assistant professor. And he was appointed after he retired as director of a United States-wide pharmaceutical surveying the industry, including the schools. And a part of that was responsibility that he visit schools to see if they met the accreditation standards set up by the American Foundation for Pharmaceutical Education. And fortunately, as a young assistant professor, an experience for a young assistant professor. So I got to know him. You know, we traveled together. It was great. Hubdi followed him. And Hubdi was more research-oriented. He was interested in nuclear physics. The fact is, he was in the nuclear industry business before he became professor and president here. And he was the one that got the idea of starting the bionucleonics department. He coined that name. Bio means biology, nucleonics, nuclear physics. Nuclear physics applied to biology. That was his doing. And he appointed me as coordinator of bionucleonic research, and later I became the head of the bionucleonics department. So that was his main forte. And then Hansen was much, much more student-oriented than any of the other, and he spent most of his time in that direction. Although he was the one, along with Provost Haas, that worked with me in starting the new school of health science. He was interested in the health aspect. And then following that, we had Behring. And Behring was kind of in between research and student. He was good, very fluent speaker, outstanding man, as they all were, though. We were just fortunate, Purdue, to have all these outstanding men as our president. And I got to know him fairly well, but we didn't have anything specific in my area. Most of what I did had already been done. And then, of course, Martin Ziske, who had put his attention on finding funds. He was responsible, however, for appointing me as a distinguished professor of bionucleonics and health sciences emeritus. So that was our main relationship with Ziske. Well, that's a quick summary.
That's a good review.
It was a wonderful, wonderful group of men.
And one thing, you know, the transcript's going to become part of the library's archives, special questions. Have any comment on archives or preservation? Anything that you think about? Just in general, I mean, because some people, I think people today realize more about preservation and the value of it, and I think this is a question that I try to ask, and interesting, because you know that that's where it's going to be. It's going to be for the researchers to use.
Well, I think it's extremely important what you're doing, and there has been a big surge of interest in archival records, and one big area is this area that you're conducting, where it's interviews, person-to-person interviews, and, you know, that's been done by, well, I know Frank Lloyd Wright Building Conservancy, the Frank Lloyd Wright Foundation, have all made recordings of clients or outstanding people associated with those organizations. I presume other universities are also doing this, although I haven't heard specifically that that's the case. But I think that's very important, along with collecting information like the bio sketches that someone's interested in. It's available.
Yeah.
It makes it. And that's part of the preservation of the history of the university.
Right, good. I think that just got us to think of something else. Any topics and questions, but I think, is there anything, any closing thing that you'd like to make a comment on?
Well, no, I think we've covered it very well.
Okay.
Very fine.
Okay.